Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, as humans, we are hardwired to seek connections. Yet researchers say that in today's world of social media and constant connectivity, we are lonelier and more disconnected than ever. In the second half of today's show, we'll look at how to develop and deepen friendships with a friendship expert. Shasta Nelson is her name. She's the author of Frentimacy, How to Deepen Friendships for Lifelong Health and Happiness. And there are good health reasons why we need good relationships in our lives. Coming up first, when people first get married, they often think they're on the road to utopia. But research tells us that more than 50% of those marriages end in split-opia. That's the name of the new book by journalist and author Wendy Paris, who writes about love and relationships. When she herself found herself wanting a divorce, she knew she didn't want to fight with her husband and have a lengthy, ugly court battle over custody of their son and their assets. So she did what most good journalists would do. She began researching uncoupling, which led to her latest book, and that's just been released. It's called Splitopia: Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. I sat down with her last week, and I'm going to bring that conversation to you right now. Wendy Paris and the book Splitopia. So, Wendy, I've never understood myself why so many marriages begin with a ceremony in church yet end in a court of law. And yes, many of those are acrimonious, but it's always seemed to me there could be a better, kinder way of uncoupling. And your book really is all about this. And you say in the book that you'd been complaining. Let's begin with this. You say in the book you'd been complaining for years about your marriage. When you and your husband finally announced your decision to separate, you assumed friends would say, hey, that's great news, and celebrate with you. But you received pushback. What happened?
Right. I thought they would bring over champagne and chocolate truffles. And, you know, it's not that it was so horrible or that they hated my husband. I just thought they would recognize that we were very unhappy and that we were taking steps to fix that. But what we got was this pushback about ending the marriage. One friend said, well, maybe you're just unhappy in your career. And this was a fellow freelancer, and we'd been complaining about our careers together for years. But the assumption that, no, you know, I don't really know my own mind. A divorce can't be better than a bad marriage was, you know, something we encountered and were surprised by. Another friend, a happily married friend, said, I know a number of women your age who are single, and they have been unable to meet someone new. This could happen to you, too. You know, it was this kind of...
Right.
And, yeah, so I was quite surprised by that. This was in New York City and, you know, a pretty liberal community, but they really had a lot of reverence for the state of marriage, even if it was a bad marriage and even if they weren't married themselves.
Well, there's that famous line I'm thinking of in Sleepless in Seattle, when one of the guys says, oh, you know, single woman over the age of 40 is more likely to be killed by a terrorist or something like that than find a good husband. But you found a lot of those studies that people base their perceptions on are just not true, simply not true.
Well, that's one of them, right? That's a total fallacy, that idea, but it sort of circulates. And I point to two particular studies, one from the early 70s that seemed to show that a third of children of divorce were still really suffering 10 years later. And you know, there are no other studies that reach that conclusion, and no one refers to that study except for, you know, very right-wing, marriage-focused organizations or individuals who want to scare people into staying in marriage. So, you know, I look a little bit about at that study and what the current research shows, which is about 80% of kids of divorce do well in life and show no lasting negative impacts on their grades or their well-being. And there are a lot of steps you can take to protect your children going through divorce and raise happy, healthy kids. So that's one study. And then there's another study that was from the late 70s that seemed to show that women lose two-thirds of their standard of living upon divorce, and men gain a third of the standard of living. And this study was one of the most cited studies of the 1980s, and it, you know, was circulated everywhere, and President Clinton quoted the study, and other sociologists at the time were saying, this doesn't track with our research, like, where are these numbers coming from? And one of them finally got the study author to give him her data, and he recalculated and came up with women retain two-thirds of their standard of living upon divorce in the 70s. They don't lose two-thirds, and that retaining two-thirds is also a bleaker view than seems to be true. But that study author had flipped her numbers, like she saw what she believed to be true. And mm-hmm. I think then she issued a retraction and, you know, acknowledged she made a mistake. But people don't read retractions in sociology journals. So this sort of has gone on to be part of the lore of, you know, the bad myths about divorce.
Yeah. Very interesting, because people tend to buy into those studies without looking at, you know, who put the study together, why it was done, how it was paid for, and, you know, is it in fact accurate? One of the things that I love about your book is you say it's time to change the conversation about divorce, because I can remember even as a teenager when, you know, I only knew one person who had parents who were divorced, and you kind of whispered it, oh, their parents are divorced. You know, people did not talk about it. And there's still to some extent that closeted feeling of shame when a marriage doesn't work out. So how do we begin to change the conversation? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. That's sort of the argument of the book. You know, this book does a few things. It's attempting to make an argument that we need to change how we talk about divorce, and then it profiles people in positive post-marriage relationships, and it follows my own separation to divorce, and then gives actual tips and help for how to structure a positive relationship and a happy life on the other side of marriage and going through a divorce. So I think changing the conversation is partly, let's talk about the couples who are doing it well. You know, let's look at happy unmarried families and, you know, shift our focus away from the horror stories that are so fascinating but don't really represent what many, many families look like on the other side of marriage. And then I'm also, you know, in my book, I'm wanting to say, let's look at what the research really shows and understand that our fears are coming from old studies and also the facts of an earlier era, like before no-fault divorce, when you could only get divorced if you could prove your spouse had committed a crime, that we still have this idea in our heads, like, oh, it's only okay to get divorced if I can prove that he is, you know, has shown criminal behavior or such egregious moral behavior that a divorce is warranted. We still have that in our head, but the law doesn't require it. So this is another sort of attempt to change the conversation, is to say, let's look at what the law really asks for today. And the law looks at divorce more as a restructuring of a family. You know, you're not required to prove he's morally wrong for your divorce to be right. And I think that knowledge can help us, you know, kind of rethink divorce and family and relationships more generally. So those are a couple ways.
Right. And there are so many different views of marriage today and what constitutes a marriage. People are, you know, I know people who are married and have been married 20 years and have lived bicoastal for 20 years.
Right.
It works for them. And the same is true of divorce. You know, there are many ways, you have great resources at the back of the book, many, many ways for us to handle it ourselves without getting attorneys too much involved, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a big point I make. You know, the book is not, you know, heavy on the legal, but because we have no-fault divorce in every state, you know, no-fault lets you get divorced merely because you're miserable. You know, you don't have to prove that the other person hit you or had an affair or committed a felony. And no-fault created the space for other types of more collaborative divorce, such as mediation and collaborative divorce or collaborative law, which is when you each hire a lawyer, but each lawyer signs a contract that if she can't help you settle your case out of court, she has to give up the case. And this is actually really important, because in the old style adversarial divorce, you're preparing to take your spouse to court. So you can't do something like say, well, I'm going to move out and we're just going to give it a try there, because your attorney will say, well, then she could take you to court and say you abandoned the children and then she could get sole custody. But I'm saying you don't want to be involved in that kind of conversation. You don't want to be involved in a conversation of maybe you're going to go to court and sue each other for sole custody. You have no business suing each other. So with collaborative divorce, each lawyer says, we're not going to court. We're not suing each other. We're working this out together. And it's really important. So that's it's kind of expensive because you're each hiring a lawyer. There's also the DIY divorce. You can download forms. You can get informed about the laws of your state. A lot of lawyers will do something called unbundled services, where they'll let you hire them for an hour to explain the laws or take a look at a document you've drafted with a mediator, if that mediator's not a lawyer. So you can get some help without putting someone on retainer who sees it as his job to advocate for you against your spouse. What people are saying today, people in the family law reform community say, is what's in the best interest of one person is not necessarily what's in the best interest of the family. And we need to look at this as a family and restructure, how we raise our children, how we handle our money in a way that's going to work for everybody.
Yes, you have a chapter in the book called Breaking Up a Marriage, Not a Family. And I love that. And you mentioned that statement, when people roll up their sleeves and say, I will sue you for sole custody. You say it should be barred from divorce or classified as hate speech.
Oh, it's just horrible. And, I know there are certainly cases where it's appropriate if, a spouse is, a drug addict who's also violent. There's cases, of course, where a person is divorcing an abusive spouse. And, absolutely. But you hear this uttered in families where they're both, high-functioning working professionals, or somebody has, been a stay-at-home mom and, totally competent, and the other person has been the bread earner. And they do this thing, I'm going to sue for sole custody, as a bargaining chip. And it is such a threatening thing to say, and it certainly doesn't encourage your spouse to say, okay, great, let's work together, right?
Right. Far from it. Well, we're going to take a quick break. I have a ton more questions for you when we come back, Wendy. My guest is Wendy Paris, journalist and author. Her new book is called Splitopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. Stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Breaking up. Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Nobody wants to be a spectator in life, so get empowered and feel part of something bigger with Kara Bradley. Her new book, On the Verge, shares how to be more rather than do more, how to experience rather than merely achieve. And Helene Segura shares strategies to kick chaos to the curb in her new book, The Inefficiency Assassin. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Break it up.
And And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Wendy Paris. She's written a book called Splitopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. And Wendy, you've written from your perspective in this book and what you learned about your divorce in this book, but you also include a ton of really solid, well-researched, great information for people going through divorce. Looking back as you were writing the book, what were a couple of things that you wish you'd known as you were going through your divorce yourself?
Boy, you know, I was doing this research as I was going through the
divorce. Oh, okay.
I had the opportunity of saying, you know, there's a couple chapters in this book that were not in my original proposal. Like, shortly after we split up, I realized that I'd written a lot about love and a lot about marriage, and I wrote a dating book and a couple wedding books, but I had never written about divorce. And my parents divorced when I was 5, and I grew up with step-siblings, and, you know, it was part of my life, and I realized I wanted to write about it, and I started, you know, I wrote a couple essays about my own experience and, you know, with our early separation. It was right at the beginning, and, you know, I had this experience of my friends being so negative, and I wanted to know why, and I was walking around saying, you know, I'm working on this divorce project. Like, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but as I started to do some more research and, you know, talk to people and got connected to people on Facebook who had good divorces, I started to say, okay, I want to write a book about this. I want to, you know, I got clear that I want to say we need to change how we're talking about divorce and take a look at how to do it well and take a look at what positive psychology tells us about coping and thriving and resilience and how can that be applied. So I wound up, you know, I sold the book sort of early on. You sell it on a proposal, and then I started working on it, and I wound up having a few chapters in my book that were not in my proposal because I didn't know I was going to need them. Like, I have a chapter on medical crisis because I had a medical crisis, which it turns out is not so uncommon in divorce, but I didn't know that going into it. So, you know, because I was writing the book, at the time I talked to my editor about this, and she said, oh, you know, I've heard this before, and I think that's really something you should consider adding. And then I started, you know, interviewing some more people, and there were times, there's a woman in here, a social worker in Indiana who I talked to a lot, and there were definitely times when I would call her and say, why is this so hard? This is what just happened. What should I do? Were there research for the book? But it was, you know, it was, so I had this funny, this is, you know, fun as a journalist, the you know, to be able to really immerse yourself in your topic. But, you know, so I had this funny, I would say fortunate experience of sort of having an excuse to call anybody I needed to call. Like, I, you know, reached out to George Bonanno, who's a bereavement expert at Columbia, you know, during the same medical crisis. You know, it's, my chapter is called Hurricane, you know,
and yes.
Sort of got interested in, you know, what do we know about bereavement? What do we know about post-traumatic growth? You know, what do we know about change through loss? So, I think what I wish I had known is actually in there because I, you know, I got the information as I was going.
Right. You share what you call 7 principles of parting. I wonder if we can take a high-level look at that. The first is commit to self. Compassion. I remember when I was going through my divorce and I found I was down in the Southern California area and phoning around attorneys, and a couple of guys, attorneys, told me, number one thing is take care of yourself and be kind to yourself.
That's nice that you got that from attorneys. That's nice.
Yeah. I actually ended up not using an attorney, but it was great advice.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I just, you know, as an aside, I think it is good to get information from an attorney. You know, like, we'll get to my principle number 3, which is don't confuse filing with closure. You know, don't hire me right away. But this thing about getting advice from an attorney. Sure. So your attorney was giving you mental health advice. And my first principle, commit to self-compassion. It's based on a really interesting study about divorce done at the University of Arizona. And they wanted to look at what kind of positive traits correlate most strongly with positive divorce recuperation. And it turns out that self-compassion was more important than high self-esteem or, you know, even like length of marriage. And self-compassion is a Buddhist principle that has been codified into Western social science as being comprised of viewing yourself with understanding and forgiveness, you know, rather than condemnation, seeing your experience as part of the universal human condition rather than, you know, some unique failing, like understanding that we all have struggle and suffering. That's part of the human condition. And another part of self-compassion is remaining mindful. And mindfulness in divorce means being present to how you're feeling, you know, acknowledging it if you're having difficult feelings. Don't just drinking it away, you know, don't try to drink it away or, you know, hide from it. But also being able to put down your negative feelings and really enjoy the positive moments in your life, not getting overwhelmed by the difficulty of your divorce. So that's all under self-compassion, which is my first principle of parting.
Right. Number two is taking ownership of the future and the past, because, of course, you can't move on. And, you know, if you're living in that victim state. Number three is don't confuse filing with closure, as you mentioned. Tell us what you mean by that.
People talk about divorces, it's an emotional and it's a legal process, and one affects the other. And sometimes people say, I just want to get through this, I'm going to hire a lawyer, you know, and I'm going to be done with it. But you might be done with the legal part of it, but there's still the emotional separation, the physical separation, the sexual separation. A lot of us feel responsible for our partner, and, you know, pulling your sense of responsibility back to yourself takes time. So I'm wanting people to really slow down and not rush to hire the first lawyer they meet, because that person may be very adversarial and you're still in a scared or angry state and you're vulnerable to what could turn out to be really bad advice. And, you know, we absolutely see this. People start out with good intentions, they hire the wrong lawyer, and it becomes this downward spiral that can be, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and even more costly emotionally.
Yes, yes. Number four is building a toolkit for the transition. You have some great resources on your website for that, too.
Thank you. Yeah, I say people compare divorce to, you know, having a hurricane hit their house. And a lot of us have these emergency preparedness kits, you know, in our closet for a natural disaster. And since, a divorce can be very chaotic, it can erupt suddenly. You probably haven't planned for it. You know, you plan for your wedding, but you don't really plan for your divorce. So build a toolkit is saying, okay, you know, how are you going to handle the logistical details now that it's going to be one of you managing your house, not two? You know, who are you going to talk to when you're upset now that it's not going to be your spouse? Who's going to be there to take you to the emergency room if you have an emergency? Just preparing yourself to get through that transition and go from being part of a couple to somebody who's living alone.
Yeah, that definitely helps if you've got that planned ahead of time and don't have to deal with it in the middle of yet another crisis. Numbers 5, 6, and 7 are combat anger with empathy, resist the urge to compare, and create positive moments. It's all about a lot of it is about being mindful, isn't it, of our behavior?
Yes, very much about behavior. And, you know, this term psychologists use, self-regulation. And, you know, I think this idea runs through the book. How do you, you know, combat anger with empathy? How do you manage your own anger, your own fear, so that you're not lashing out at your ex and making the situation worse?
Yeah.
You know, how do you self-soothe? How do you pull up your empathy for his struggles too, or her struggles too? Right. The same with resist the urge to compare. You know, I'm saying stay in your own divorce, stay in your own situation. You don't want to compare yourself to the worst divorce you've ever seen and assume that will happen to you. And you don't want to compare your recuperation to that of your spouse, because, you know, this is your life and you get to take your focus off your spouse now and put your focus on yourself.
Yes. I can't tell you, you know, in my former life, in my former career, I was a banker. I cannot tell you how many seemingly happy couples that I had known as a banker for years and years, when the divorce started happening, they turned into these spiteful strangers. And I always wondered how that could possibly happen. How could these two people who loved one another and these two people who were friends suddenly become these spiteful strangers? So there's a lot to consider going through that. And I think if people are evolved at the same level, that's really what it takes to come out of this in a more healthy way, isn't it?
Yes, but, you know, absolutely, absolutely. But even if your spouse is not evolving, you can have a big impact on how your divorce unfolds by managing your own emotions and your own behavior, because it is interactive. And I've had this happen a lot, where somebody is telling me her side. You know, she's telling me about her narcissistic, crazy, you know, the men are always narcissists, codependent or bipolar or something, you know, and divorce. So she's telling me about her narcissistic, you know, maybe bullying husband, and, you know, on and on. And I can hear in the story what she's doing wrong. You know, I'm hearing only one side, and I can hear in that side how she's contributing. And I've absolutely heard this from men too. You know, she's so crazy, she's insane, she did this, she did that. And I'm hearing it and I'm like, whoa, you also just asked your children to lie to their mother and not tell them that you moved out of town. Like, that's, you know, there's
right.
So what people, you know, and I know this can sound harsh, it's, you know, it's hard enough, but what people, you know, don't recognize but can be very empowering is that if you can take control of what you're doing, you can really improve your ex's behavior. I found this difficult in marriage, but in divorce, in some ways, it's easier because, you know, you have a lot more space and you don't need to agree on everything. You only need, you know, to agree on your roles as parents if you have kids, or how you're organizing your, you know, your settlement agreement. You don't need this full personality overhaul that a lot of us were trying to engineer in marriage counseling.
Yes. And that's the key, is to take your power back and not give them, you know, give all your energy out to what's wrong with them. It's to fix yourself and move forward. We've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I really want to get this question in, Wendy. You know, because I think once you've talked it out of your system, you really don't want to keep repeating the same story. And I know when I got divorced, I moved to a different state. So everybody I met went, are you married? Were you married? How long were you married? What happened? And I felt like I kept reliving it. And I decided one day, I can't keep telling this story over and over, because it brings back up those emotions that you think you've, you know, long forgotten. You suggest we come up with a divorce elevator speech, and I really liked that idea. And you suggested that for a couple of reasons. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you've had that experience, because I also moved across the country, but I find a lot of people are much more interested in telling their own story than hearing mine. So they, you know, that's interesting that they, you know, they were interested. So I talk about, I went to Mexico on vacation and wanted a test drive talking about divorce, you know, and I was worried it would send people running. You know, how are people going to handle, you know, now I'm in my 40s, I have a child, and I'm divorced. And so I, you know, was on vacation and telling different shopkeepers and things, and people were pretty, you know, enthusiastic and encouraging, and, you know, I really believe this new lipstick that I'm selling you is going to help your life. You know, it was positive. And then I got back to New York, and, you know, real life settled in, and I had a lot of worries. And I talk about being out with a friend and her mother, and the mother started pressing me, well, why are you getting divorced? Well, you're sure you need to get divorced? Well, what did he do really? And I started, you know, I felt like I had to defend my decision to divorce. So I started saying a lot of negative things about my, you know, we were still married, my husband, and then about me, and then about our marriage, and I could not stop. You know, it went on and on, and I had made this big, you know, public proclamation, we're having a good divorce, and we're not asking anyone to take sides, and I'm at dinner, and I cannot stop, you know, and what was wrong with him and what was wrong with me. And I got home and I thought, whoa, you know, I need an elevator speech like when business have, you know, like a prepared little talk that's going to present my divorce how I want it to be seen and protect me from, you know, getting caught off guard and speaking defensively or, you know, being too tired and saying something that's going to make me feel worse. And I talk in this chapter about emotional contagion and how, you know, the way we present our story impacts how others feel about it and then the emotion they feed back to us, so that you can get this kind of contact low, you know, and not realize that you start, you know, you like lit the match. Like, that's sort of how I talk about it.
Right. Excellent. Well, I have a lot of books come across my desk. You know, so, there are so many divorces in the world today. And with self-publishing, it seems like almost everyone who goes through a divorce wants to write a book. This is not that kind of book. This is extremely well-researched, extremely well-written. You did a great job, Wendy. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think of the book as, thank you for saying that, I think of the book as being about divorce, but also really being about relationships and how we treat the people in our lives and how we treat ourselves. And so, you know, a lot of the ideas in here are about, you know, this person you were married to, but there's many people in our lives. We have conflicting relationships, we have conflicting emotions, and, you know, the book is attempting to kind of harness the best of research and positive psychology today and help people live better lives and have better relationships with themselves and with others, whatever the legal form of that relationship.
Well, Wendy Paris, thank you for being with us. I know listeners can find out more about you and your work and that toolkit we mentioned at your website, wendyparis.com. Thanks for being with us, Wendy.
Thank you.
And Wendy has a whole host of resources up on her website at wendyparis.com. She's got recommended reading, a divorce manifesto, and a ton of really helpful resources to help you uncouple healthily. And so stay with us, because we're going to continue the theme of relationships. We're going to talk with Shasta Nelson when we come back about how to deepen friendships for lifelong health and happiness. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
I can't afford to compromise with someone I don't recognize. I'm splitting up.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, April 10th, it's a best Sunday with Dr. Nels Rasmussen, and we'll have open phone lines. Dr. Nels can help with emotional, behavioral, or physical problems. He can test for allergies, drug, or supplement compatibility and dosages for you or your animal friends. Call us for a free remote session. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Nobody wants to be a spectator in life, so get empowered and feel part of something bigger with Kara Bradley. Her new book, On the Verge, shares how to be more rather than do more, how to experience rather than merely achieve. And Helene Segura shares strategies to kick chaos to the curb in her new book, The Inefficiency Assassin. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, we're continuing our conversation about relationships. This time we're talking with friendship expert Shasta Nelson. She's going to be joining us by Skype in just a moment. Shasta is the founder and CEO of GirlfriendCircles.com and has been featured on the Today Show, Katie Couric's Katie, and many more media outlets, so you may have seen or heard her before. And she lives down in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's written a great new book called Frentimacy, How to Deepen Friendships for Lifelong Health and Happiness. Shasta Nelson, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be able to talk about this subject.
Yes. Well, let's first of all define frenemacy, and then I want to. I have got a couple of questions about you before we dive into the book. So, what do we mean by frenemacy?
So I found that when I'm talking about intimacy, everybody immediately thinks of sex and romance.
Right.
So I was like, this is an uphill battle. So I'm coining a new word to remind all of us that we need far more intimacy in our lives than simply romance and sexuality can provide. So this is about the deeper platonic friendships that we want to develop.
Right, right. Shows where our minds go, because that's really what intimate means.
It's so true.
So tell me how you became a friendship expert. What got you interested in this topic, this subject? Actually, it's a huge subject.
It is a huge subject. Well, like, probably about 8 years ago, I actually started a website, thegirlfriendcircles.com, which is like a match.com for women looking for friends. And it was kind of through watching how difficult it was for all of us to figure out how to make friends. You know, in the romantic world, it can be challenging, but we have lingo, we have like process in place, we know how to, you know, get picked up on, how to flirt, you know, we have these like practices and skills and expectations around it, which can be messy as well. But when it comes to making friends, I found that many of us just were at a loss of like, how do we do this when we aren't in school or we're not meeting people at work? And so I've been studying friendships ever since then in a way to say, wow, friendships are some of the most significant relationships we will have. And most of us are not, we have so many stigmas and uncertainties around how to actually develop them. So I've been studying it ever since then. And this is my second book. So it's just been great to be able to use that as an excuse to research and study and share whatever I can learn.
Right. Well, I'm happy to read in the book that you are married to your best friend.
Yes. This is important. And, you know, research is showing that for women especially, marriage is not always a guaranteed health booster. Our friendships can impact our health in far more ways. And so it's really significant how much emphasis we put on parenting and romance. And yet the more I've been studying this, the more I realize we simply can't get all of our needs met in those few relationships. And there's so much that we can gain from our friendships outside of that. So
yes, important point there. And the book is geared primarily for women. But as Eric and I were chatting before we called you up on Skype here, it gets harder. It gets more difficult, seemingly, to make friends as you become older because everybody's so busy. They're tied up in their lives. Maybe they've been betrayed a few times along the way. Mm-hmm. Some people, as they get older, become more rigid, less flexible. They don't want to make the effort. So talk to us a little bit about what you mean by, you talk in the book about loneliness and lonely. So let's begin by defining that first of all.
Yeah, I am really big on broadening the definition of this as well, because many of us are, I treat it more like hungry. And so just because we're not starving and malnourished doesn't mean we don't know hunger regularly. In fact, I feel hungry 4 or 5 times a day and need to respond to it. And so for us to treat loneliness the same way we treat starvation is unrealistic. We really need to say loneliness is something we will feel regularly if we're healthy, and we'll be, and the healthier we are, the more in touch with ourselves we will feel. And loneliness can surprise us, because I actually think we have an epidemic of unacknowledged loneliness in this country, because we're so afraid to admit we're lonely that we're kind of stuffing that, you know, pushing it aside and not acknowledging that, yes, wishing I had deeper friendships is a form of loneliness. Not feeling like I know who to call tonight is a form of loneliness. Wishing I could just have a comfortable, meaningful, long conversation is a form of loneliness. So it's not, when we speak of loneliness, it doesn't mean we're recluses. It doesn't mean we don't have good social skills. It doesn't mean nobody likes us or that we have no friends, you know, all these fears we have around right. loneliness. It simply means that is information our body is giving us that says, I want more connection. I want more meaningful connection in my life right now.
Right. And you call this gap between friendships that we have and friendships that we really desire. You call that the intimacy gap. Talk to us a little about that, if you will.
I will. I surveyed 1,200 women a year ago to rank, and this would be great for all of your listeners to say to yourself, if you had to score your level of satisfaction in your relationship on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most meaningful, most fulfilling, most satisfying, what number would you give yourself in your level of satisfaction with your friendships? And most women, most of us are hovering, you know, 6 or below. We are twice as likely to put a 1 or a 2 as we are to put a 9 or a 10. And so that intimacy gap that you were referring to is the distance between whatever number we give ourselves, whether that's a 3 or a 6, to that 10. And so my entire book is designed to say, you have something, let's build on that and let's deepen these friendships and figure out what it takes to actually move that number closer to 10, you know, to raise that level so and close that gap so that we actually can say, I feel really deeply known and seen and loved and supported in my life.
And interestingly, you say in the book that, you know, I often have heard this from women. Oh, we must have women friends. I love my women friends. And you know, I have to say I have a balance. I have, you know, a couple of my really closest friends are men. And I'm wondering if that's maybe how I was brought up. I don't know. But you say there's a lot of hype around women's relationships.
Yeah, there is. And so much so that I think we can put a lot of guilt and shame on a lot of women unnecessarily to feel like, yeah, if you don't have this Sex in the City group or, you know, this tight foursome or this best right. friend you talk to every day, something's wrong with you. And I think that's tragic. And I will also jump in and say, when we speak about men's friendships, I think it's tragic that we haven't cast more of a vision in front of men for deep men's friendships that they can have as well, you know. And so we all of us need them. There shouldn't be any shame or guilt, but it should be certainly an invitation to all of us to grow up saying, am I getting my needs met, or do I still feel like I have more capacity to love and be loved? And if right. my answer is yes, then what can I do to create more of that in my life and develop more of that?
Okay, we're getting a little interference on the phone, so now is a good time for us to take a quick break, which we normally do anyway, and we'll see if we can fix that. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Shasta Nelson. Her book is called Frentimacy, How to Deepen Friendships for Lifelong Health and Happiness. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org, but you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're having a conversation about friendship in this segment. My guest is Shasta Nelson. She's a friendship expert. She writes about it. She's also the CEO of GirlfriendCircles.com. And her new book is called Frentimacy, How to Deepen Friendships for Lifelong Health and Happiness. So Shasta, we've talked a little bit about, you know, some of the gaps that we have in friendships, and why do you think it's so difficult today? I mean, obviously we're so connected, you know, people have got all these social media friends and they boast about how many friends they have, but then there's this, with some people, still a longing and that emptiness there.
Yeah, I am finding that for most of us, our loneliness isn't coming because we need to meet more people. For most of us, it's that we're not going deep enough with a few of the people we already know. Like, we are more networked than ever, like you said, and more connected, and yet feeling less deeply connected. So I really want to speak to the recognition that for many of us, it's not a call to go to more networking events or right. go like spend one more night going to girls' nights out and stuff like that. It's really an invitation to say, do you feel like you're seen? Do you feel like you have enough vulnerability and intimacy and support and consistency? And that does take a consistent time. And so, yeah, we live in a world where our worlds are not set up for this. Our culture does not prioritize this. You know, there may have been a proverbial time where we sat on front porches and connected with neighbors, or sat in tribe and in community and cooked together and watched the kids together. But we certainly now find ourselves prioritizing family, work, and having very, very little time for this. So it does kind of go counteractive to what we crave and need.
Yeah, and I think you hit on a key point there, the time. We have to make the effort here, because in the book, you looked at all kinds of reasons why people say they don't have friends. Oh, it rains too much, I never want to go out. Oh, it's too hot, I never want to go out. I have children, whereas other people say they've met their friends through children. And I was thinking about, you know, where have I met? I've got friends that I've had for since I very first moved to America, which is like 28 years ago. I have a couple of friends that I've known that long, and then others that I've known 15, 20 years. But I was thinking, where do I meet people, you know, the newer people that I know? And I've always met them through my dog.
Nice.
I've met them on the beach walking.
That's awesome.
But
yeah, it's funny because I just came home from book tour, and in every city I do a Q&A, and it's so funny because after every event somebody will raise their hands and say, well, I just found that here is the hardest place, you know, and you know, Seattle it was because it was rainy, or you know, and it was just so funny that every location, and I just thought, our brains are trying to make sense of like, why is it so hard? Like, where do I meet people and how do I get that consistency? And I think it's helpful to say it's not a personal problem. This isn't necessarily you're doing something wrong or you live in the wrong place. It's just recognizing that our world is not yet prioritized or set up for this. And we kind of have to be countercultural to put in the time and figure out how to, you know, build those relationships.
Yes. Right. And so acknowledging that intimacy gap is key. And I want to go back to this with a story that you begin the book with. You talk about, because I've kind of been in this situation myself once or twice over the many years I've been around. But you begin the book with a story about meeting up with your Tuesday night girlfriends and how you drove home feeling utterly frustrated and neglected because you realized there was a gap between friendships that you wanted and the friendships you tell us to have, and you felt your friends never ask you about your life. They're just not interested. And this is something that I've heard many, many people say. Mm-hmm. And I can think of people that occasionally I talk to on the phone, maybe a couple of times a year. They talk for an hour and then they might go, oh, by the way, how are you? Oh, bye bye. Mm-hmm. So tell us, you say we have some responsibility in that.
We do. I have an entire chapter in the book on that mutuality, that lack of mutuality, because this is a really, really big issue. And the bigger issue is the story we assign the action, you know. So for me, when I was driving home, I was assigning the meaning, saying I'm a better friend than they are. They don't care. They weren't thoughtful enough. They didn't ask. They're selfish. You know, we kind of like create these labels. And the truth of the matter is they actually were very interested. They got distracted. And I don't even think anybody realized, but they certainly would have been heartbroken if they saw that they hadn't spoken up. And now I realize it's my responsibility just as much to offer what I want to share. And I don't need to wait to be asked. And I've watched other people do that so well with me, where at the end of the night, I think I wouldn't have even known to ask about that. You know, I'm so glad they just said, oh, I wanted to tell you about this too, and make sure you heard about my mom. And we have to learn how to show up and not take it personally or not feel rejected. So that doesn't mean they don't need to practice something as well, but we have so much more potential of creating that friend-timacy that we want if we're willing to kind of show up and say, what can I do in this situation to increase my odds of having my needs met?
Right. So you talk at length about leaning into intimacy. Tell us what you mean by that.
We have to lean in when it gets awkward. I use the metaphor of the health club a little bit because when we go to the gym, we know that we're going to sweat. In fact, we feel disappointed if we go to a workout and feel like it didn't really work us out. And we expect to sweat. We expect our muscles to feel strained and tired. We know our muscles have to tear a little bit in order to get bigger and stronger. And yet, when it comes to our emotional health, anytime it gets a little challenging, a little hard, our breathing's a little fast, it's a little exhausting or awkward, we just pull away and say, oh, this can't be a good situation because I don't feel good. And I'm inviting us to say, our emotional growth is very similar to our physical growth. We have to lean into it, even when it feels like we want to pull away and dismiss and put up walls and break up and all of this. There is times where we need to be able to say, okay, this isn't ideal. It's awkward. I need to figure out how I can show up in here to ask for what I need and to help this relationship get stronger. And we do this in romance. You know, I talk about this with women all the time. We may not like conflict, but we will do it with romance. We will have those talks where we say, wow, I'm not getting my needs met. I don't like it here. This isn't working for me. And yet when it comes to our friends, we almost get upset if they don't read our minds and right. show up perfectly. And we just say they're not a good friend and we walk away and think that we need to keep looking for this right person.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you make. It's very true. It's very true.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate. So then what happens is that we don't have that many friendships that we actually have gone through some of the stress and disappointment and unmet expectations with, which is what we know builds safety and builds trust and builds intimacy. And so we don't have to do that with everybody, but if what we want are those safe, intimate relationships, we do have to go through disappointment with some of them and figure out how to forgive and renegotiate and move on in a healthier way.
Do you think as a society, we give up too quickly on friendships?
Yes, I do. And that's not to say, but actually it's, you know what, that's a tricky question because I think we put up with stuff for too long too. So I don't think that it's put up with things more. I think most of us tolerate something as long as we can. And then we just say that's the last straw and we quit and we give up. And so I don't think that we need to just put up with things longer. I do think we need to earlier on say, wow, this pattern's not working. What can I do differently? What can I talk about? What can I shift to help try to transition this into something more meaningful?
You talk about our need to be vulnerable and to open up. And for some people, that's difficult. You know, if somebody's very introverted, how do you coach them to open up?
So I teach a friend-intimacy triangle in the book, and it teaches the three requirements of friendship. And one of those is vulnerability. And I teach that vulnerability should be increased incrementally as our second and third requirements are being built and developed. So the first requirement is positivity, and that always needs to be present before we start being vulnerable. So positivity is feeling good with the person. And then consistency is the second requirement. So positivity, consistency, and vulnerability. So therefore, when our vulnerability starts increasing, it should only be escalating as our commitment or our consistency or our regularity, our trust gets built up with that other person. So let's pretend you're on a scale of 1 to 10, you have something really vulnerable that just feels like a 10, like whatever would be the hardest thing for you to share with somebody. Then when you're at brand new with somebody, you should be sharing things on a scale that are closer to 1s, 2s, and 3s on the vulnerability scale. And only as that person becomes more and more safe, through consistency, do you practice saying more and more and revealing yourself? So therefore, the risk is never that great because you're never taking a stranger and just throwing a 10 at them. You're like practicing so that really you're only escalating up to a 4 with somebody and you've practiced sharing a 3 before, for example, if we've got a scale. And so it's not as risky if we do it in safe escalating ways with somebody that we're, you know, practicing positivity with and mutual sharing. But we have to do it. It's a muscle. It's a muscle we have to build. So whether no matter our temperaments, we want to be seen. And the only way to be seen is to truly accepted is to be seen, and which means we have to reveal ourselves. So it is a requirement.
Yes. What a great book and a great conversation here. I would love to invite you back. I'd like to talk about toxic relationships and when do we actually give up on relationships, if you'd like to come back and join us.
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Great question. I think the final thought I'd want to leave our listeners with is that for so many of us, when I was studying this book, I have a whole chapter on rejection, and that was one of the most favorite ones to study and just realize how much our fear of wanting to fit in and belong and be accepted is driving all of us. And so my hunger for you and my prayer for everybody is that we would figure out how to actually feel accepted and not let our fear of not being accepted stop us or be obstacles to us really figuring out how to do this. As scary as it may be, it's so, so, so worth it for our health and happiness, truly.
Well, Shasta Nelson, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it very much.
My privilege. Thank you for talking about it.
And listeners can find out more about Shasta Nelson's work at girlfriendcircles.com, girlfriendcircles.com. She has a blog up there, and I'm telling you, every single question you've probably thought about friendship, she's put in a blog post somewhere up there. So, we'll try and get Shasta back and talk about toxic relationships and when to end relationships, because I think that's a key part of us not misstepping along the way. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Shasta joined us today by Skype. You can find me at 1-800-495-7617. If you have any questions or feedback on today's show, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-495-7617. And you can also email me at info@conversationslive.net. We're also on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.